Okay, thank you very much, Pranya Devi. I must say I'm delighted to be able to come and give one of these talks, although I feel I'm far too young to be an elder. But I started very young. So, actually it's not completely true, but... So you hear the term elder, it does conjure up some kind of wise woman who's, you know, grey-haired and... Anyway, and also I just think it's such a great idea that these talks have been done at this class. I was really delighted when Shiva wrote to me saying that you'd had that idea to do this, and because history's so subjective really, isn't it, in the sense that there are so many different stories. So recently Vajragupta wrote the Triratna story, which I imagine many of you have read and seen, and I think he did a great job considering how clumsy our history has been, you know, as the history of any organisation or spiritual community is. How can you possibly tell a history that spanned 40 years and however many different countries and continents? So I think he did a really, really good job with that book, and I'm very aware of the many, many stories that are not part of what he was able to write up. And as he is, he's aware of that. And I always think hearing personal histories is very compelling, and it gives a kind of mosaic of something. So the Triratna story in history, or the Western Buddhist order as it was before, it's a mosaic of all sorts of different people's stories. And I think the more you hear, then obviously common threads emerge, and you see how some people can live the same events, and actually they could have been living completely different events. I remember once being in a retreat, a pre-retreat, where Attila had us choose a year, and everybody had to talk about that year. And the year that was chosen was 1983, I think, or something, or 82. Anyway, there are all these different people who had lived together in the same place. They'd lived upstairs, in fact, and it was like their stories, they could have been in different planets, let alone in the same community. So I think there is something really lovely about hearing all the different stories. And I know you've already had quite a few, and I haven't managed to hear, other than Damodinna's, I heard some of. And it's just delightful to be at the LBC anyway, to give anything. I'll talk about anything at the LBC. Because in a way it was my home for so many years, as Pranya Devi mentioned. I actually lived here for about 12 years, and I worked at the centre in some capacity for all of that time. So it does feel a bit like coming home to give, sorry, to come and give a talk at the LBC. But anyway, that's to jump ahead a little, so I'm going to go back and start. So I got an email from Shubhat, I can't remember, it's probably about a year and a half ago. And she said, this is the kind of things that we're interested in. And she was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there were 6 things that she thought people would be interested in. So all I've done is cut and paste that from the email, and I'm just going to talk about those particular things. But actually, it means I don't even have 10 minutes for each thing, so I'll have to talk fast. So if English is not your first language, it's not mine either, so we should be fine. I know when I get more Glaswegian as I get more excited, so just wave to me if I'm becoming incomprehensible. So the first bit was significant phases or events in my spiritual life, experiences, meditations, retreats and contexts I've lived or worked in. I could do that for the rest of the evening. But I thought I'd just basically talk. I guess the most significant event or phase was my ordination. So I came along to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre in October 1978, and I actually was in quite a state when I trundled up to the Glasgow Centre's front door. I think looking back I was probably having a nervous breakdown, but I didn't realise that at the time. I'd had a whole series of bereavements and a whole load of really awful things happening in my life, and I was really quite at the end of my rope. But and also I'd been very politically active and had become very disillusioned with that. And I was kind of really looking for something. And I thought I might be pregnant, which would have been an absolute disaster. And I mean, for the child more than anything else. It would have been a disaster. And I went to have a pregnancy test, and I wasn't pregnant, and I came out of the pregnancy advisory service, and I was sitting there thinking, I must change my life, I must change my life. Some of you have heard this before, that I must change my life. And I walked out, and there was a poster in the wall that said, change your life. And I thought, okay, that sounds good. And it was an advert for a series of lectures at the Glasgow Buddhist Centre. They were recordings of Sangharakshita's lectures, and it was a series called Buddhism for Today and Tomorrow. So I rang them up and they said, oh, just come up and have your supper. They were very friendly. And so I went up to this flat in the west end of Glasgow, and I had a meal with this bunch of guys who lived there and ran the Buddhist Centre. One of the guys had just come back from a solitary retreat. I shall name no names for the sake of the guilty in this talk. And he started talking about this solitary retreat that he'd been on, and he started talking about these meditation experiences, and I thought this was really fascinating. And then he started talking about how many times he'd been masturbating every day. And I thought, what have I walked into here? Shall I leave, you know? But then I was also a bit fascinated, not by that particular line of thought, but they were also just so kind of like enthusiastic and really kind of interesting guys. And I stayed and listened to this tape lecture, and it was called A Blueprint for a New... Well, no, it wasn't actually. It was the... Anyway, it was part of this series from 1976. And I had been really tearing my hair out about thinking I really want to change the world. That's what I was interested in. I wasn't particularly interested in self-development. In fact, I don't think I'd even heard of the concept. And if I'd heard of it, I would have been completely uninterested. But I wanted to change the world. And I'd realised, I'd had this massive realisation that you couldn't change the world without changing yourself.
Duh.
And I remember thinking, but what on earth, how do you do that, you know? So anyway, I stumbled into this Buddhist centre to change my life. And I heard this talk by Sangharakshita, which said, the first view that we must change the system is generally regarded as a secular view, a materialistic view. And the second, that we must change ourselves, is generally regarded as a spiritual view. Personally, I cannot agree with either view completely. They are not mutually exclusive. He goes on to say, a bit later in the same talk, in the FWBO, we are concerned with the development of the individual. We regard this as crucial, fundamental, even where the question of transforming the world is concerned. I was like, I've come home. There's this person talking about exactly what I've been looking for, how to change the world by changing yourself. But you don't change yourself just to be nicer or better. You change yourself so that you've got the tools to change the world. So I was like, where do I sign? You know, I sign up. And actually, it was quite funny because I'd been very involved in pretty left-wing politics. I'd been part of a Marxist think group in Glasgow, which was a combination of different Marxist groups. And so I was used to listening to something and then arguing about it. I mean, really arguing about it. And we heard this tape lecture by Sangharakshita, and I was scribbling all these notes. And at the end, the guy who was leading the class said, "Does anybody get any questions?" And I was like, "Me?" You know, and I had this great list of sort of really pokey questions, and I was really argumentative, and they all looked completely terrified. It was great. And then, one of the order members from there, Damirati, put his head in the door, and he hadn't actually been at the class. And I said, "Well, I know you." And he said, "I know you." We couldn't initially remember how we knew each other, although we did later. But that's for another talk. And I said, "Oh, your name's Ian, isn't it?" And he said, "No, it's Damirati." And I was like, "What?" Actually, I wouldn't repeat what I said because we're in a shrine room in front of a Buddha figure. "What kind of name is that?" And he said, "Well, it's a Buddhist name and it means, you know..." I said, "Well, what does it mean?" He said, "Oh, it means delighting in the Dharma." And I was like, "What's the Dharma?" So he ended up giving me a Dharma course. I went home at 3 a.m. and I was hooked. That was it. Never looked back. So that was in 78. I think I asked for ordination in February 77 when I first went alone. And I asked for ordination in February 78 when I became a Mitra. And I was really shocked that I didn't get ordained immediately. I thought, what's the matter with these people? And then I realised it was actually Sangharakshita that had to ordain you. Now, I will talk. One of the questions I'm asked about is my friendship, including with Bhante, so I'll come back to that. But anyway, so a significant event was my ordination. So I was ordained in Street Farm in Norfolk, which was had been a women's retreat centre, had gone back to being a family home for a couple of order members and their kids. But they very kindly moved out to let us have our ordination retreat. And it was absolutely magical. It was a weekend. So these days, most women get ordained on a three-month retreat. Those that can't make a three-month retreat get usually a two-week retreat. If they can't manage a two-week retreat, we usually try and at least do a week's retreat. Anyway, ours was a weekend. And we had the private ordination on the Saturday night, public ordination on Sunday morning, and then went home. And neither Vidyashree nor I, we got ordained together, went to take our cases off. And we went for a curry somewhere in Brick Lane. And Damodena said, you have to take them off before you eat curry. Because turmeric is very hard to get out of cases, so we kind of took our cases. I had a white one at that time. So it was absolutely magical. The retreat was based in the Bodhicharya Avatara, which was my completely and utterly favourite Buddhist text, and still is very high on that list. And we made all the offerings from the Bodhicharya Avatara. It's got all this section. The offering section in the Sevenfold Puja is a very watered-down version of what the actual text says. And I can't remember how many offerings there are, but there's loads, and we made them, including things like forests. So we brought in all sorts of trees and things like that. It was fantastic. And then the private ordination was that evening in a chicken hut. And we went off one at a time, of course, to be ordained privately. And just Bhante, Sangharakshita, and me, in my case, and him with Vidyashree. And I have no idea how many of you here are relatively new to things, so forgive me if I'm saying things that you all already know. But in the private ordination, there's just you and your private preceptor. And it is quite a magical kind of moment. And I went in, and he was sitting there in his robes and all very sort of, you know, meditative, and then he opened his eyes and he just broke into this amazing big smile, and he said, oh, at last. And I said, yeah, quite. Something like that, you know. And actually it had been 2.5 years since I'd asked for ordination, so it wasn't in fact that long, but it felt like a long time. And we got through the ordination ceremony, and he said, when it came to the bit, there's a bit in the ceremony where it's actually changing a wee bit at the moment, but at that time there was a bit in the ceremony where you said if there was a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva that you felt connected with, and you were given a visualisation practice around that figure. Now, I didn't realise this, but a lot of people apparently at that time just went in and asked Bhante what they should do. I didn't know that. So I went in and he said, well, I imagine you know what you want to do. And I said, yeah, I said, well, look, I've been thinking about this, actually. So first of all, I thought I'd quite like to do Padmasambhava. And he went, oh, no, I don't think so. So Padmasambhava, for those of you who don't know, is a very sort of energetic figure. And I think Bhante thought it was really the last thing that I needed was more of an energetic figure. And then I said, oh, but then I'd been thinking about Manjugosha. And he said, I don't think so either. And I thought, I wonder why that is. And then I said, but what I've come round to is Avalokiteshvara. I said, yes, I think that's good. And so I will say a bit about my, later on, I think I'm asked about that. I'll talk about the, how that kind of came to be that I asked for that particular figure. Anyway, and then of course there's a bit where you're given your name, so you get given this new name. And he said, I still quite strongly remember this, he said, I had no trouble at all with the name for you, I've known it since the first day I met you. And I went, wow. And he said it was Parami, and this meant constantly transcending. In my public ordination, he made a big point of saying, many people think the term Parami means perfect or perfection. Now, those of you that know Parami will realise that's not the case. He said, it means constantly going beyond. Going beyond. And then he smiled and he said, or even going over the top. So he had a little sense of humour with money. But I actually loved My Name Immediately. I just thought it's fantastic. It's short. That was good. And it was fairly pronounceable. So I liked that. Of course, at that point, I had no idea I was going to go and end up working in the Spanish-speaking world, where my name can cause some gaiety. Because it means, para mí means for me. So people would ring me up and somebody'd say, oye, es para mí, para ti. Or they'd say things like, you know, somebody'd say to me, what's your name? And I'd say, para mí. And they'd say, yeah, but what's your name? But no, that is my name. And they'd say, oh, okay. Yeah. Anyway. And the thing that I really loved about it, and I'll pick up threads of this later on, if I manage to fit it all in. But the thing I really loved was Bhante said, this term, it's very connected with the Bodhisattva ideal. So because the Bodhisattva practices the paramitas. So I knew that your name had to be connected with the Bodhisattva ideal. I was like really, really moved. And I will come back to that. So, yeah, it was just an amazing experience. And I can still remember walking to the private shrine with these little night lights. And it just felt really magical and kind of going into this secret kind of place and getting this new name and walking out. So, say, Vidyashree and I were both ordained in that same weekend retreat. And some of you know Vidyashree, I think. And that night we were sharing a caravan in the grounds. So we were, and of course the retreat was in silence. So she said to me, we were sort of lying there and she went, psst. What? She said, do you like your name? I said, yeah. Do you? Yeah. So we did this whole conversation. I don't know why we were whispering. We were in a caravan in the middle of nowhere. You know, the house was quite a long way away, but I guess we were keeping silence. And she said, how many syllables is it? And of course, your name, you don't reveal your name until the next, well, whenever the public ordination happens. So the idea is that it's kind of yours, between you and your preceptor until the moment that it's kind of made public. And we did manage to keep it, but I tell you, it was tough. The two of us were like, what letter does it start? And then I suddenly couldn't remember mine. It just went completely out of my head. I thought, is it Pudgala? No, what does that mean? I just couldn't remember at all. And I thought, oh, well, never mind. I'll hear it at the public. It will be fine. So, anyway, that was very definitely a significant phaser event in my spiritual life. I mean, there's so many. It's quite hard, actually, to know how to sort of choose them. But just continue a wee bit with the sort of biography aspect, I guess. So I went along to the Glasgow Centre, as I say, at the end of 77. And I just absolutely loved what I walked into in so many ways. It was also a period when things were changing quite a lot in the ordering movement. I was the only woman involved in Glasgow for some time. I was the only woman mitra for quite a while. Well, actually, when I became a mitra, there were two women, but she disappeared like weeks after we had our mitra ceremony. And there weren't any other women mitras. There were some women that came to the centre, but they weren't that, you know, I was just like, let me at it. I was really so going for it. And I wanted to live in a community, but there weren't any other women that wanted to live in a women's community. And I had a mitra study group, which was a bunch of blokes and me. And they all went off in this weekend event. And they came back from the weekend event, I think it was at Padmaloka, I can't remember. And it was at the period where we had done everything really as mixed, and it was at the period where the genders were, as it were, separating, and we were beginning to have single-sex activities. Now, I think the fact that we do single-sex activities is one of the strengths of our ordering movement. I think it's fantastic, particularly, I think it's great for women to be independent and do, you know, feel that we've got the resources. We don't need to look necessarily to the men's wing for things. Although, of course, I think it's great that there's, coming together and that we work well together where necessary. But I think the whole single-sex thing's fantastic. But let me say, it's Genesis was not easy. Now, I don't know whether people have talked about that in some of the other talks, because a lot of the women that have given talks were involved at the same era, as it were. My own experience was that there I was in Glasgow, totally committed, really went to get ordained. I was working full time in the university library. I was in the centre almost every day. I was either cleaning the centre or I was at a class. And I was just totally there, totally committed. I was supporting every course that was ever done. And then the guys all come back and they said, I went out for my Monday night Metro study group and they said, oh, we've decided it's a men-only group. And I was like, so what do I do? Oh, well. I was so angry. So I had this set of keys to the Buddha, you know, to the centre. So I threw the keys at one of the men order member and stomped out the door and said, again, I won't repeat what I said, but it was along the lines of, you may keep your Buddhist centre. I don't want it. And I stomped off out the road and Damaratti came running after me up the road going, come back, come back. And I was like, no way, bunch of misogynists. I'm doing anything to do with you. And he said, no, no, it's not like that, honest. And he managed to persuade me to calm down a bit and just have a conversation. But it was really quite difficult because it was a period where in some ways everything had been open to everybody and then suddenly there were all these restrictions. As it felt to me, there were restrictions because I was the only woman. And then there was another one woman who'd come along just a bit after me, Vajramala. She ended up getting ordained, although she's since resigned. And it was really quite difficult, so I just decided to leave, basically. I went to see Bhante and he said, try and hang on if you can, because it'll be harder for other women to get involved if there's nobody there for them to relate to. So I hung on for all of 6 months or something, and then I moved. But it was a really interesting period because, you know, when I've talked about this quite a lot, and I've talked to the people concerned as well, and had some really quite amazing, very emotional conversations with some of those guys. And I really, looking back, I can really understand what they were trying to do. You know, they were trying to build up something. A lot of them had realised their dependence on women, their emotional dependence on women. The movement was, you know, trying to kind of start something up. Sangharakshita had started saying it would be really good if the men did things together and the women did things together. But none of us really had the maturity to think why that might be and even to think of how to do that in a way that would be helpful for everybody. It was very abruptly done by some people, not by everybody, but by some people. And I think some of those people, it was because they could see, some of the guys could see their own need to separate out and to kind of, I guess, become more individual in their relationships with women. But it was crudely done. And I see what I brought to it. I was a Marxist feminist. You know, I was used to sort of like fight in the corner. So there was no way that I was going to take that and just think, well, that's an interesting spiritual lesson. I wonder what that's about. You know, I just really came at it. And looking back, I can see how many filters I was wearing, you know. And I used to go and see Bhante and sort of say to him, and they did this and they did that and they said this and did you really say that? And he'd say, no, I don't recall saying that. And he'd tell me the context of something and I'd think, oh, that sounds quite reasonable, really. So in a way, looking back, I think Bhante had a very strong idea what we would all gain from starting to work more with our own gender. And I think there's so much to gain in that, you know. And it's not just, by the way, if I may say so, it's not just that you don't get distracted when there aren't men around. It's not my experience. you know, and that's, it might be part of the experience for some people that if you separate the genders, it minimises to some level sexual attraction. It doesn't work for everybody. And what happens quite often is that perfectly straight people suddenly find themselves attracted to their own sex because there's nobody else there to do it to. So it was quite a kind of turbulent period. There were all sorts of things going on. People were exploring their sexuality. People were exploring sex. They were exploring what it meant to be Buddhist. And we were so immature. I was so immature. I really was. So that kind of, in the end, I decided I would move down to London to live in a women's community. So I did that. I moved down to Wanstead, of all places. If anybody that knows Wanstead. And I worked in Wanstead Public Library. And that was a really interesting period as well, because everybody else in the community, there was one Irish woman and everybody else was English, and I'd never lived with English people before. And they're very different. And they all went to bed at 9:30. and I didn't. And I'd just been travelling with a rock band just before I moved there. So it was a complete shock to my system. And they talked about psychology at breakfast. And most people were incredibly apolitical. In fact, they took pleasure in being apolitical. It was a point of pride to some people that they'd never read a newspaper. There was somebody in my community who had never stepped in a public library. And this was so alien for me. It was like such an alien world. And I don't think they knew what to do with me at all. I just burst in on it. If any of you, I don't know if you've read Dhammadina's, there's a chapter from Dhammadina in a book about friendship, which is it The Moon and the Flowers? And she's written about a friendship with me, actually, in that book. And she, I think she says something like that, that I burst into this community and dragged her off to see Star Wars. And, you know, it was this community where people were very, you know, I think the whole thing about Buddhism was that a lot of people felt Buddhism was very tranquil. And I really wasn't very tranquil at that time. Of course, I'm so much more tranquil these days. But it was just like, talk about culture clash. You know, and I was probably the only extrovert in the house, I think, as well. And I was Glaswegian, and I swore, and I drank, and I smoked dope, and I did all sorts of things. And I really tried my best to, you know, convert, but it wasn't a smooth transition. And but it was fantastic. I was living with 12 other women, and it was amazing. They were all completely committed to the Buddhist path. They really, you know, they really practiced. They were really into their meditation. And this was what I really wanted it. But we had a common purse. That was another quite amusing thing. We got a bit of history. We had a common purse at that time in the community. So everybody put in all their money and we got £2 a week pocket money. And I was the only person. There were two of us in the community that had work in the world, had jobs. I worked in the public library and Marit, she worked for Reuters Press. So we both put our wages into the pot with everybody else's dough money. This was 1978, remember? And we get £2 a week out. Now, it costs a lot of money to work, you know? I couldn't live on that, basically. And that was quite interesting. You have to go to the community and ask if you wanted anything else. And I used to get really frustrated because people could get money to go to classical concerts and I couldn't get money to go and hear Ian Dury and the Blockheads. So it seemed like a very unfair system to me because that was refined and what I wanted to do wasn't refined. So it was really challenging, and I think I learned an awful lot, and I'd like to think that some people learned a bit from their connection with me too. And it was, you know, it was ever so good-natured. I was quite disappointed when we stopped having a common purse, actually. I was really into that. I was very idealistic. I'd been a communist. So as far as I was concerned, everything should be held in common. Anyway, I started living in communities then. I'd lived in political communities beforehand. And when I moved into my first Buddhist community, I was quite surprised by how non-communal it actually was. So that was quite an interesting experience. But, you know, I could also see that I was bringing such prejudices of my own into that situation. So it was definitely a learning curve for everybody concerned. Anyway, I'm talking too long about that particular thing. Although one of the things here says difficulties you have grown through, so I've just jumped into that one. So I guess in many ways the whole gender separation thing was probably the biggest challenge that I had to face in my time in the ordering movement. And in some ways I see it as one of the strongest points of our movement. And as I say, particularly for women, I think it's really great that we actually, for example, the fact that women ordain women, I think it's fantastic. I think it's so empowering in a very positive sense, in a spiritual sense. I think the fact that we're able to make those decisions, we're actually able to witness women entering the order. And although, you know, there was all this kind of separation, and I think for the women it was probably more difficult, generally speaking, at that time. Sangha actually, right from the word go, went to an order where men and women had equal ordination. That was actually quite unusual in the late 60s. It was quite visionary, and it was very definitely part of how he saw a Western order would develop. So there was this kind of dual thing. you know, there was this sense that we were completely equal and that there was nothing that was barred to women in terms of involvement in the movement, and there was kind of quite strong messages from some of the men, not ever in my experience from Sangha Raksha, ever, but from some of the men order members, and I think they were the least mature men. In a way, there was quite strong messages about hierarchy and men being better, etc. So I that was a couple of times I almost left the order around that particular stuff. And a couple of occasions like that was, on one occasion, you know, the LBC does these big retreats, summer and winter. And we started them in 1980, so I was in the team for the first 18 of those retreats. 9 years, I did them 2 a year. And in the very first when I was a mitra, I was in the kitchen, I was cooking. And about 2 years later, I was leading one of them. And it was the first time a woman had led one of those big retreats. It had been Manjivati, sort of men, very senior men order members to that point. So I was leading it. And the LBC council got a flurry of letters saying that other chairs of different centres were not going to send any of their people to this retreat because it was being led by a woman. And so I was on the council, of course, so I got, you know, went to this council meeting and, you know, look, this is kind of what's happening. And so I said, well, I'll just go and ask Banty what he thinks. He lives upstairs. Or he was visiting, I can't remember. So anyway, I went up and asked him and he said, that's ridiculous. Actually, there are very few people that should lead those retreats, but I'm quite happy with you being one of them. And I would like to see Damodina lead one too. So he was very affirming, and so I could march back down and we sent letters back to all these chairmen saying, you know, well, if you don't want to send people, that's a shame, but, you know, Parami is leading this retreat. And actually it was the biggest one that we had at that point. It was one of the biggest ones. And that's a whole other story, that retreat. That was a difficulty that I grew through. But I might come back to that actually, because it was an interesting one. So I'm rambling a bit, but there's so many things. So yeah, that was one little story. And then there was another one where we used to have mixed order weekends. When I first got ordained, we had mixed order weekends here. Well, we originally had them up the road because this was just still being, it had just been opened just before I got ordained. And we used to have these mixed order weekends, and we'd sit around in that room out there and report in everybody, about 70 of us. He'd listen to every single person reporting. That was all we did. And they were brilliant, actually. But there was probably about 7 women, and the rest were all men. I loved them. It was great. There was a real sense. I loved the meditation with that number of people, and I loved chanting with a lot of men chanting. I still like that, actually. I still really like when we chant on order events, and they're, you know, that's the bass coming in. I really enjoy that. Anyway, so I really enjoyed, and then we decided that we would have single sex order weekends. So that basically meant the men still had their order weekends here, and the 10 of us or whatever it was that were in the UK would go somewhere else. So we were up the road having ours in what's now Bodywise, which at that time was the annex. And Siddhi Ratna, who's one of the order members around here, he came up and said, oh, he'd had this idea, why didn't we come together on the Sunday afternoon for the order Metta and a Puja? Great idea, we'll do that. So the person that was leading the men's order weekend came and looked for me and said, well, you lead the Puja, you lead, you know, you do a nice puja, as it were. And I was like, yeah, I love leading pujas. Happy, happy. No worries. And then about half an hour before I was going to do it, somebody, he came back very sheepishly and said, a lot of the men won't come if you're leading it. And it was really interesting because I had to sit with that for a bit. It was probably more than half an hour. And I sat there thinking, and we talked about it, and the women we all talked about it, and some of us were saying, don't, we won't go then either, you know. We'll do our own puja. And some others were thinking, and I initially started thinking, well, dash them if they don't mean to come. We'll just go and I'll lead it anyway and they can just leave. And then I actually thought, is that really what I'm going to do? And I thought, no, it isn't. I don't want to be, even though I think it was ridiculous and I felt it wasn't in any way positive, I felt I did not want to contribute to further polarisation in a situation that was already really polarised. So I decided, against some of my friends' advice, that I wouldn't do it and that we'd let the guys do it. And we did. And actually, it was a bit of a turning point for me, because there was something, there's a text in Tibetan Buddhism, which I hadn't come across at that time, which says, give away the victory and take upon yourself the defeat. And had I heard that at that time, I would have thought, no way, Jose, you are kidding. But actually, there was something about it as a spiritual experience where I just thought, I don't need to fight my corner like this. This is not really my problem. This is not my issue. I'm perfectly confident in my spiritual practice. I have no need for affirmation from anybody. And I'm quite happy to sit in a puja led by anybody that wants to lead it. So it was quite a kind of, that was a difficulty that I think I grew through. So, anyway, other significant events. Well, actually, I'm going to carry on in the difficulties. And this is more to do with me, really. It's terribly confessional. But I got ordained, I was 28 when I got ordained. I had so much energy and so much enthusiasm. Cannot imagine. And I became, within 3 months, I think, of being ordained, I moved here. I was ordained in West London. I moved here. And I became secretary for the LBC, which actually meant I was secretary of the FWBO. So I was holding a major responsibility after 3 months being ordained. And there were, when I was ordained, I was the 19th woman to be ordained worldwide. And there was, I think, about 12 of us in the UK, something like that. And some of them were mums, so they weren't that active. So there was quite a small number of us, maybe 10 of us, that were particularly active, leading retreats and things in the LBC. In Britain, that is. And so when I was asked to become secretary, I thought, I can do that. My confidence completely was way ahead of my ability. But I've never let that stop me. So I moved over to the LBC and I became secretary. And I was running the LBC within a few months of being ordained. And it was the most incredibly creative period, I think, in my entire order life. There was a fantastic team of people here doing things. Damarati, Attila, Damodena, myself, a whole load of other people, but we were leading most of the classes. I was working basically probably about 100 hours a week. I was leading weekend retreats, I was leading classes, I was going up to Manchester to lead things, I was going up to Glasgow to lead things. So what's changed? So, and I was, you know, I was just going all over the place and doing all sorts of things, and I could not understand why everybody wasn't doing it. And I was so crass about it. When I look back, a lesson I've learned, and I don't think it's peculiar to me, I think it's probably true of the Order and movement at that time, was we were enthusiastic, we were naive, we were idealistic, and I don't think we were very kind to each other, really. And I don't know how a movement like this gets built without that kind of energy, to be perfectly honest. I think there's a real need for that kind of, you know, pushing kind of energy. But I do think quite a lot of people go burnt in the process. Some of those people left. A lot of them didn't leave. A lot, you know, and I'm so grateful to the people of the generation before me that were just willing to kind of keep going and create the conditions for my generation and people coming after that. But, so I started leading everything, really. I was so upfront and, you know, I mean, I've got 5 planets in Leo. And I'm a dragon. I couldn't help myself. When I was wee, there were 2 things I wanted to be. One was Prime Minister, and the other one was a famous rock star. And I didn't do either of those things, but I think I just found my ability. I found a forum, I found a stage, and I went for it. You know, looking back, I don't regret that period at all, but I was completely out of my depth. I was way too ahead of myself. Well, you know, we've been talking a lot recently about spiritual death and spiritual rebirth and the need for integration and positive emotion. I had no integration and very little. I had quite a lot of positive emotion, actually, but it wasn't refined positive emotion. So I think I was just really ahead of myself. So after a couple of years of doing that, I had basically fallen out with almost everybody that didn't do things the way I thought they should. And the 2 people that I was working most closely were 2 guys, the chairman and the treasurer and myself. We were the kind of office bearers. And things just got so bad, basically, that Sangha actually fired me. He sent for me and said, No, he didn't actually send for me initially. It was really horrible, in fact, because he told one of the guys that he thought I should stop being doing what I was doing. And this person came back and told me that, I think with a certain amount of glee, actually, which I don't blame him, because I was so horrible to him. But it was a real shock. And I went and phoned Banty and said, what's this? You know, and he said, well, come and see me. And he said to me on the phone, you have reached the end of your spiritual tether. In fact, I think you've gone beyond the end of your spiritual tether. It was so humiliating. So I had to go up and see him. He was living in Pavmaloka by that point in Norfolk. And I went to see him. And he just tore a strip off me, actually. And basically told me I'd get caught up in power. And he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. And a lot of it was the male-female thing. And a lot of it was that I felt I represented the entire female race. And that I could never display any vulnerability because I was letting down womankind. And I felt like, and I had to really kind of, felt I had to fight my corner a lot. And I mean, to be fair, I did have to a bit, you know, it wasn't all me. It was a dynamic that we'd got caught up in. But something had to break the dynamic, and what broke it was me being asked to leave, which seemed terribly unfair and unjust at the time. And it did feel, it was really humiliating. Because I was such a public person, my humiliation was public. Everybody knew about it. Everybody I lived with, everybody in my chapter, everybody in the council, everybody at the LBC knew that I'd basically been fired by Banty. And then I was put under house arrest. I can think of no other way of explaining it. I used to basically have to go to Banty and say to him, I've been asked to lead a retreat and such, what do you think? And he'd say, no, I don't think so. Or he'd say, yeah, I think that's all right. I had to go and ask for permission for everything that I had to do. And it was so humiliating. It was absolutely excruciating. But I am so grateful. I just don't think I'd be the person that I am if I hadn't had that experience, because it really pulled me up against my conditioning. And I think, to be fair to me, I had the kind of guts to stay with it. You know, it would have been very easy to leave, and I did think about it. But actually, I thought, no way, I'm staying. So, anyway, that was a terribly humiliating experience. And I stayed at the LBC for 10 years after that. And my relationships with people just changed immensely, as things changed externally as well. But that was a big event in my spiritual life, being fired. I don't think many people have actually got the... can say they've been fired directly by Sangharakshita. So you see, I've even managed to turn that into... But one of the things that I realised looking back was that for all sorts of reasons, too psychological to bore you with the details, I had very... I had quite a strong sense... I had a strong need for identity. And I think I got that identity to some extent from teaching. And from being up front and from people liking me and people thinking that, you know, I gave good talks or I taught the Dharma well. And I think what Banty saw was he cut through that, because he realised, in retrospect I can say, I was using the Dharma to shore up my ego rather than putting my talents at the service of the Dharma. And that was a huge turning point for me as well. And I remember having a conversation with Damarati, and I was saying to him, I just think I should stop teaching. And he was saying, well, that doesn't actually resolve anything. He said, that's a bit like, you know, in a way, if you do that, you don't get the benefit of the challenge of keeping on the coal face, as it were. But then people don't get the benefit either of the fact that you do it well. So it was, again, it was a huge thing to try to stay in there with that and kind of work with that. This is all terribly personal. I thought I'd be much more talking about the tree rat in order. But anyway, I suppose it gives some sense of how things were at that time. Particular friendships, including Banty. Well, I think I've already said a bit. I mean, I think I've been very lucky with my relationship with Banty. As soon as I went to the centre, the Glasgow Centre, the first day I went there, Damarati gave me the Three Jewels and the Survey to read. And I'd read both of them within about a week. And I wrote a long letter to Sangharakshita full of questions. And he just wrote back to me immediately with answers to some of my questions. And he said, come and see me and we can have a conversation about this. So I went to see him very quickly. And we spent about 2.5 hours talking about the stuff that I'd asked him. I didn't know that was unusual at the time, but I realised quite quickly that a lot of people were very awkward around Bhante. They found him quite difficult, quite a difficult character to just feel. You know, he was the teacher, he was very upfront, he was obviously miles ahead of anybody else. It was quite hard for people, I think. And I never really had that. I think I just didn't realise initially quite who he was. So I'd already built up a relationship with him before I realised just how extraordinary a person he actually is. So I'm really grateful for that. And he, I think, liked that. I think probably it was quite relaxing for him to have somebody that didn't, you know, feel very awkward and anxious around him. So I've always had a really good friendship relationship with Bhante, and I've worked alongside him quite a lot over the years in different capacities. And I used to do things like go with him to buy birthday presents for his mother and things like that. So I had, you know, I saw a very different side of Bhante to, I think, what a lot of people, kind of, especially people coming along these days, see. So I'm going to just talk a wee bit about Bhante. I probably should draw to an end, although there's so many other things I would have said. But, so the first time I saw Bhante, I just went to visit him. And my mother had died not that long before. And he was just so kind and so sort of friendly. And I went to see him. He was living at Padmaloka. I went to stay where there was a women's community in the retreat centre where I eventually got ordained, although this was before I got ordained. I'd only been around for a couple of months. My mum had died in February, and I went to see him in March, I think. And I stayed with a women order member called Malini, who I loved to bits as soon as I met her. I just thought she was just magic. And she was so kind to me. You can't imagine. I was in a terrible state. And she was so kind. And I went over from there to see Bhante, and he was so kind. And I was telling them about the fact that my mother had died. And I started talking about how many people had died in the previous 2 years. And he just said to me, "My goodness, that's a lot of people." And I hadn't really thought of it. It was a lot of people. And there's something about him just saying that and being so sympathetic. I just thought, oh my God, there's so many people. And I had a real breakthrough. It kind of broke through something. I think I was quite cut off, I think, from my feelings about it. It had been so much, really. So I started kind of writing to Bhante, and I used to write to him. I used to write like 30-page letters to him. I hope he's destroyed them. Long letters all about how I was going to be a bodhisattva any minute, and you know, things like that. And poor Damodina used to get copies of them as well. I used to write her all these. I think she has still got some of my letters. And I, you know, everything I read, I had to dissect and write about. I must have been an absolute handful, which is great. Be a handful. It's good to be a handful. Anyway, So I started kind of building up quite a strong friendship with him, but then I started, he was still doing a lot of public talks. So I don't know how many of you here have actually heard Bhante give a public talk. Some of you will have. This was a period when he was just prolific. He was giving so many talks. And the series that I remember most was the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and it was in the East West Centre. I was living in South London at that time. I wasn't ordained. It must have been 79. And we used to drive up to hear these talks. And every single week we got lost going home. We went on one occasion going from the East West Centre to Streatham. We found ourselves on the North Circular. But it was because somewhere we'd just been transported into this other world. I can find no other way of describing it or explaining it. There was this guy who had, you know, kind of greasy hair and didn't look like anything terribly special, charismatic or anything. And then he'd just start to talk, and I could just feel my consciousness being raised as I listened to him. It was an extraordinary experience. And I felt that in all the talks that I heard. And that was what kept me in the movement. So when things were a bit difficult between, you know, men and women, for example, or other things that were difficult, like when I discovered that there were people in the order that voted Conservative. I'd never met a Tory before I got involved in the FWBO. Working class Tories didn't exist in Scotland when I was young. Anyway, all sorts of things that shocked me. But, you know, all sorts of things and times when I thought, I just don't know if this really is the right place for me. I'd remember those listening to Bhante giving those talks. I just knew he was my teacher. And I knew that whatever else happened, his vision to create an order that could be a force for good in the world was the vision that I had dedicated myself to, and I had no doubt I was going to do that. And I have never ever doubted. From the first lecture that I heard, I have never doubted that I'm a Buddhist. I've never doubted the three jewels. I've never doubted Sangha Rakshita as my teacher. Doubted a lot of other things. Me. Doubted me. My capacity, my ability. And I've doubted people, some people. But I've never lost that fundamental faith, really, in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And I've never lost my fundamental faith that the way Sangha Rakshita set up this order is exactly what the world needed. And I don't mean that in a sectarian or a triumphalist way, I really don't. But I really believe that we have got something to offer a world that desperately needs the values that Buddhism has got to offer. So, you know, whenever, even if times get tough, I just remembered some of those talks and just remembered sitting in that hall and just feeling myself just getting completely transported. It was better than any of the drugs that I'd ever done. So Banti just is an extraordinary human being. And, you know, there's things I find difficult about Banti. There's arguments I've had with him over the years. There's ways he's acted at times that I wish he hadn't. You know, there's all sorts of things about him. And I had this image a few years ago, actually. I had this image about my relationship with Banti. And it actually came from a seminar of his where he's talking about people as they change and grow. And he uses this image, which is of a lampshade, and light shining through. And he says, as people grow and develop more, as they become closer to enlightenment, they become, the light that shines through is the same light, so they become more similar. But because it shines through the particularity, I mean, this is not a direct quote, but because it shines through that their lamp, as it were, then they also become very different. And I thought that was a really lovely image for the spiritual community. But what I realised was that in some ways the lampshade that is Sangha Rakshita is not to my taste in some ways. You know, there's things about... He's an Edwardian gentleman locked in a 21st century body, you know. He's very kind of English in a certain way. He's... You know, his taste in art. There's all sorts of things about Banti that I've struggled with over the years. Some of his political views, some of the things that, you know, he said. But the light that shines through it, I have never, ever doubted. And I realise that basically, I just want to shine that light through my particular lampshade. And I want to create conditions so that other people's lampshades can let that light shine through. And I also realised that it was incredibly sort of nitpicking of me in a certain way to be picking the threads of the lampshade rather than just really rejoicing in the light. So that was a helpful image for me. I sort of told Banti that. He just chuckled. I thought it was quite amusing. So, and I guess what it makes me realise is that our conditioning, our personalities... don't need to be to people's taste in a way, really. It's something else that we're trying to develop or grow through. It's not really to do with personality. And in a way, it's not to do with liking in a certain sort of sense either. Okay, I think I should probably start drawing to a close. Maybe just one other major sort of thing for me was moving to Spain. That was a really huge thing. It was quite hard to leave the LBC. And Paramachitta, who many of you know, she and I went over together to Spain. And I know it was a loss for a lot of people here. I think we were missed. Both of us were missed in different ways, in different spheres, in some of the same spheres. But we were really, you know, we were so kind of enthusiastic about it. And it was brilliant for the first year or something. And then, like any project where you go, and particularly going to a country that you don't know, I didn't really speak Spanish when I got there, and it was very different. You know, any of you that have lived, some of you sitting in this room, are currently in cultures that are not your own. I mean, it is so shocking at the beginning, isn't it? And it's fantastic because it makes you realise your assumptions about things and that people do things differently, my goodness. But also, the thing for me that was really shocking was that suddenly I was with all these people that didn't like me very much. Because at the LBC, I had been relatively popular. And again, it was another stage in that, I suppose, having to come to terms with how my ego appropriates, how one's ego appropriates things. And I got out to Spain, and like, I was this big senior order member. I was the most senior Dharmacharini at the LBC when I left, I think, because Dhammadina had gone to Tiruvannamalai. So I think I was probably the most senior order member, Dharmacharini here. And suddenly I was in Spain. Nobody knew what a Dharmacharini was, let alone what a senior one was, and they really could not give a monkeys. And it was a culture that does not take to authority kindly. And, you know, this was how many years after Franco's death, there was still massive suspicion about religion, massive suspicion about anybody that thought they knew better than anybody else. And it was really challenging. It was fantastic. I'm so glad I did that. I don't have a minute's regret about that either. At this point, I feel I should burst into song and start singing. I have no regret, but I won't. But looking back, I really don't. So I've been in the order now for 32 years. I've lived in communities for the bulk of that time. I've lived on my own for 2 years in Spain and a couple of years here in Britain. And other than that, I've lived in women's communities, and some of them were wonderful and some of them were a nightmare, and some of them were both wonderful and a nightmare at the same time. And, you know, we were all growing together. And I've worked in what was a cherry orchard, I worked in Evolution when it was no Evolution before that, and I worked in Friends Foods before it became a men's team. And, you know, I've worked in co-ops and I've lived in communities, and I so recommend it. And the demographics of things have changed so much. You know, when I got involved in the late 70s, we were a bunch of, on the whole, relatively unintegrated, kind of fairly political, fairly lefty some people, some very apolitical. A lot of us had done some kind of drugs in our background. And there was quite a lot of hippie. I wasn't a hippie. I couldn't manage hippiedom myself. It was far too nice. But there was kind of quite a lot of old hippies around. And, you know, the state, a lot of us were supported by the state. And we kind of lived in squats, and we lived in Approach Road when it was still, you know, a lot less developed than it is now. And we were willing to do that. And we were younger. We were, most of us, in our 20s. A lot of people coming along these days are already better formed than we were. And I think that's great in many ways. People are much more mature, I think, overall. You know, vast generalisation, which means that it probably doesn't apply to anybody. But, you know, generally speaking, I think a lot of people coming along to the movement these days, they've been in psychotherapy, they've been through all sorts of different group works. A lot of them have been in other Buddhist groups. When I got involved in the movement, there was nothing else really Buddhist. There were a few things, but nothing that attracted me. You know, a lot of people come to us that have already got a meditation practice. They've had it for years. So it's a very different demographic, and I think that's great. And I think sometimes I'd be sad if we lost that kind of sense of exploring and adventure that we had. And I don't think that's just to do with being young. I think it was also partly the era. You know, we were baby boomers, we were post-war generation. There was a sense of people didn't mind if they didn't have a job, they didn't mind if they didn't have a nice house to live in. And I think there was something in all that. And I'm not suggesting you all go out and find a squat to live in. But there's something about a willingness just to really throw ourselves in that I think was amazing. And I'm so grateful for the time that I came to the movement. And although there were, I think these days it's probably easier for people in some ways. But also, it's also established, or it seems to be. But it's built on sand. It's impermanent, like everything else. But it's so easy these days to walk into a Buddhist centre, and it's solid and institutionalised, and things are done in a certain way. We didn't have that, really. You know, when I came here, the LBC hadn't even opened. We were still exploring what it meant to run a Buddhist centre in a way. So I'd really like to encourage people to try and find that kind of mentality. And I know it's harder these days, But take a risk. Find a, you know, something to jump into that you really love and really sort of have a go. You know, and if any of you are thinking of living in a community, really explore that idea. Communal living's, it's a really interesting way to live. And I'm so glad that I managed to do that. So I have no regrets. The only regrets I've got is about me, because I don't think I was always skillful, and I don't think I was always kind. And I think my enthusiasm and my desire to serve, compassion meant that I was really unkind. A bit of a paradox. But I think one of the things that marks the order these days is I think there's a lot more tolerance and kindness, and I think that's great. And I think there's a lot more... people can be themselves, I think, probably a bit more than maybe some of us could originally or initially. But try not to lose youthful enthusiasm. And you can act as if, you know, you don't have to be 25. You can act as if you're 25 in a good way, you know, and just really find what fires you and what moves you and put yourself into it. And I think I will stop there. And the passage of time has affected my practice in many ways, so I've answered all the questions. Thank you.